February 2nd, 2001, interview with Linda Johnson about Victoria Parker. Earth, can she have done all that she did? That's the fascinating thing for me about her, is that she seemed to be a one-person, one-woman show in terms of Yukon. But anyway, tell me how you did meet her.
Well, I moved to the Yukon in 1974 as the first government records archivist at the Yukon Archives. And so very quickly I was into the files of the Yukon government, dating from, of course, before the turn of the last century.
Right.
So from 1898 on, those were my responsibility. And in particular, we were starting to organize the series of records that were post-Gold Rush, that were the Yukon administration. And of course, Victoria Faulkner had gone to work for the Yukon government, I think in 1918, in that period.
Yes.
So just at the time when the Yukon government had been reduced considerably, like decimated, really.
Right.
The federal government, after the First World War, needed to make savings to pay for the war debts. They found that there were only a few thousand people left living in the Yukon, that the gold rush had not carried on into major manufacturing or mining activity, and really Dawson was fast on its way to becoming a ghost town. And so they decided to reduce the Yukon Council. The number of elected members on the Yukon Council was reduced to 3, and the civil service in Dawson City was also reduced drastically. Many, many, many people were laid off, all in the matter of a few weeks. Telegrams came from Ottawa saying the Yukon budget is reduced, and
really?
All these people will be laid off. Now, Gordon McIntyre talks about his sister working as a stenographer then with the government and coming home in tears one day at lunchtime because they'd all received this news that their jobs were being eliminated and that Dawson would be left with very few permanent jobs anymore. And of course everybody knew what that meant to the community overall in terms of the general economy. So Victoria came to work in the Yukon government just at that time when things were reducing.
Mm-hmm.
She then worked as the secretary to the commissioner for...
Was he a gold commissioner at
yes.
that point?
Yes. As part of this reduction, the administration was downsized, and instead of replacing George Black, who had been commissioner, the acting gold commissioner assumed his jobs, and later it was reduced again so that the controller, who was George Jekyll, assumed all of the functions of commissioner as well. So downsizing occurred by not replacing the senior executive officers and having more junior officers assume the senior position responsibilities. We have to look back in her own tapes. There's a very good series of oral histories that Brian Spears did with Victoria Faulkner, and she, of course, is very precise in detailing exactly when she came to work for Yukon government and what her various roles were. Yes. Mm-hmm. So I met her first as a series of initials on many, 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 many pieces of correspondence. It seemed that every set of records that I picked up had this ubiquitous VAF together with various commissioners and comptrollers and other officials' names. So she was the sole remaining secretary, I think, for virtually all of the officials that remained. And at one point, I think there were probably less than 10 officials remaining in both the federal side of administration in Dawson and those services that were considered to be territorial functions. And she was then involved in virtually all aspects of government administration in the Yukon. So when you pick up correspondence from certainly the 1920s on through to I think 61 or so is when she retired, you will find VAF as the initials of the secretary who typed all that correspondence. So as a result, she used to laugh and say that, you know, she knew everything about everyone, everywhere in the territory. And I think there were probably people who regretted that she knew everything about them, no matter where they'd been in the territory.
So that's why there are people who had real ambivalence about her.
I think that plus she was a very thorough, demanding person. She was a perfectionist. And when you see these letters, they are letter perfect.
Yes.
No whiteout in those days, no self-correcting computers of any description. She was the epitome of a well-trained early 20th century secretary.
And she was trained in Dawson. I mean, that's amazing to me at the Sisters of St. Anne.
Yeah, she went to the Catholic school in Dawson, always talked about what a fine education she received there.
Including music education.
Music, art, reading. She was a very avid reader. She had a very thorough grounding in the classics, in literature, and she had a wonderful knowledge of the world, of geography.
It's amazing.
It is amazing, and certainly there are pictures of her and her sister at school here at the archives. And if you go to Dawson, to the church, St. Mary's Church, and go into the classroom behind the church, you'll see the classroom where she attended school.
Aww.
And it was, you know, truly the one-room school experience in the far north.
Wow.
However, Dawson of that time was a very proper place, which from, you know, the latter days of the gold rush, and certainly from the turn of the century, up until the First World War, there was always this expectation that Dawson was going to grow and prosper, that it was going to become one of the premier mining districts of Canada and indeed of the world. People who came to live there very often brought with them or brought in shortly thereafter very fine furniture in China, and those who had the means to do so, which was, of course, government employees in the senior ranks,
yes,
or the RCMP senior ranks, or doctors and dentists who came to live there, lived a very refined social life.
It was a kind of a high society, wasn't it?
Well, I think they certainly attempted to aspire to that, and certainly attempted to recreate what would have been at least the equivalent of small town high society in the South. Not a prairie frontier high society so much, though this was a frontier, but the impression I had was that, you know, there were people from all over the Canada and the United States, the blacks, of course, with Mrs. Black's experience of Chicago.
Yes, and I think
wealthier society.
Yes, I think
the
that.
Blacks coming from New Brunswick as lawyers had, you know, refined understanding of what society should be, and people were very anxious to see Dawson portrayed as a civilized capital city which observed the proper decorum of the times, whether it was the way women dressed and went to tea and had calling cards and at homes and all of that social activity, or the men working in their civil service jobs, certainly maintaining their standards. Obviously, some of them probably hoped to go back to work in the South somewhere, so it was very important.
It was standards of dress as well as deportment and
socializing,
all of that.
You know, they worked so hard to establish the clubs.
And there were so many clubs.
Yeah. It really, to hear Victoria Faulkner talk about Dawson of those days, she would say, you know, it was a very proper place, and that people took such pride in making Dawson a beautiful place in the summer, in keeping the roads in good order, in making sure that schools were properly run, that everything was proper. I think she was very much a person who wanted to see things well run.
And I gather she was very proper in many ways.
She was.
But she was also...
she was also an adventurer.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a question that's a side question on this that I've never been able to sort out. While I think of it, the blacks resigned in 1916 when he went off to war or gathered his contingent. Yet the archives, no, the Parliament records show him as being commissioner until 1918. Does that make sense in any way?
Yes, because he was given a leave of absence to go to Europe to the war, as many people were, but they did not have to resign their jobs to do
that. Through that?
He might have been. More likely, he went on to the payroll of the Canadian Army, Canadian Forces overseas, and would have received compensation for that.
And not a double one, I don't think.
We'd have to go and look at the public accounts for that period. It's not a question I've ever pursued.
I found it was really interesting when I wrote to see when he had resigned, and I got back while he was commissioner until 1918. That was when I was writing about Martha Louise.
Yes, and there would have been a person in an acting capacity while he left, when he left.
And George Jekyll, I suppose. But it was,
actually,
I don't remember now.
I think it might have been Mackenzie. Again, if you look in my council history manuscript,
yes.
It should be there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yes, I think everything was very much left on hold during the First World War.
That was my sense, that everything just kind of went into park.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've interrupted the flow. But, Victoria grew up in Dawson City then, obviously. I mean, she went there when she was just a toddler with her parents.
Her mother.
Her father was there
already. Yes.
Exactly.
Her father had come in, and you'll hear her talk about this on the tapes.
Okay.
You know, father came in over the pass in 98, and mother and I waited, and then, of course, her sister was born, and so the two little girls and their mother came in once the white pass was built.
Yes,
so
I believe they came.
Her mother was not about to walk across the pass with two small children, I gather, and so they made that wonderful voyage up the Inside Passage, and then they must have been amongst the first passengers over on the White Pass about 1901.
Yes, it was 1901.
And then they took the steamboat to Dawson, and their dad had claims out on Gold Run Creek, I think.
I haven't.
And again, she'll describe that in the tapes, and it's quite a wonderful story. And in later years, when I traveled to Dawson with her, we went with John Gould out and traveled all up and down the creeks and stopped at the various places where she remembered going to school as a child, because her first school was out on the creeks, and then also people that she met, miners, and the life on the creeks. It was a very frontier life. Certainly they had a little cabin.
And in something I've read of hers, and I did go through some of her records, she talked about having two or three dogs that, or perhaps it was the interview you did, two or three dogs that she mushed to school.
Yeah.
And one was hers and the other two were her father's or something.
Yes, and she'll name those dogs in the tapes.
Oh, wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And then as the children got older, her mother wanted them to move to Dawson City, and so they did move into Dawson. And her father eventually got a job in the city, and they became Dawson residents. That would have been, of course, the period when the small mining enterprises were selling out to the big
companies,
and those who didn't leave the Yukon needed to find some other means of living in Dawson. And he did go to work for the government as well, I believe. And again, she will describe that in her tapes, what her father did. And I think that was it, that he went to work in the mining recorder's office, I think, because that's where he met Frank Burton, because he did know the Burtons very well.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You told me that.
you knew the Burtons.
So that's first how I met her, was through the files. And then it wasn't very long after that that I met her in person, because she was a regular visitor to the old Yukon Archives down beside the library. She lives downtown, and of course she had her blue Betsy, her Chevrolet car.
Yes.
And we probably used to see her, several times a month. She would check up on what we were doing. She was a real fan of the archives, and every so often she would come in and want to look up this or that detail of something that she remembered but needed to verify. And so she was a great one for looking in the records. And of course she could order up the files by number, which we couldn't always match her talents for finding the records that she would want. But then of course it was a real pleasure to sleuth around with her and figure out what it was she wanted to look at. And most of the time we would be able to find the file or find some information that would help her to solidify in her mind what it was she was trying to remember to tell somebody.
Is it basically thanks to her that we have all the records that we have from those years? Or
in some ways, yes, because she was such a wonderful record keeper.
Just the box that I had and looked through, my goodness, you know.
Yeah, well, on two levels. Certainly, she ensured that the records that were created were very well filed, and they had a central filing system, and she was the sole filer, record clerk, as well as stenographer for so many years. So there was a consistency of filing the information. Now, when the capital city was moved to Whitehorse, she moved as well, is still working for the government. She was horrified by the decision to move the city. And there's some wonderful correspondence in the National Archives, which I copied, and we do have copies of it here, of the various federal officials that went to Dawson in the early 50s to sleuth out what was going on in Dawson, because the federal government had virtually lost track of events there, really, from the turn of the century, after the gold rush. They never really paid a lot of attention. When O.F. Finney was the director of Indian and Northern Affairs for the old Department of Interior and then the various subsequent departments, he had a working knowledge of the North, and he made regular visits to the North, so there was some understanding there. But then the period of the Depression and then the Second World War, other things were more important. There were fewer people in Ottawa, is my sense, that had an understanding of what was going on in the Yukon, and yet they knew the Alaska Highway had been built, there was more pressure for mining, and there was a need to kind of reassert some control and understanding of this, what looked to be about to burgeon territory. So one of the things that was very obvious was that the highway made Whitehorse a more workable administrative center, and more federal departments were setting up offices in Whitehorse, while the territorial government and the remnants of some of the earlier departments continued to operate in Dawson. So the federal government sent up a number of senior investigators to have a look at the operation in Dawson and to consider the question of moving the capital city. And there are some wonderful pieces of correspondence where those men came back to Ottawa and said that they had met one Victoria Faulkner, who was secretary to the commissioner, and it had been impossible to get any information. She guarded the files ferociously. She was very obviously hostile to their efforts to figure out what was going on in Dawson, and she certainly had an inkling as to what the reasons for their visit were and was not about to give them any help in that process. She loved Dawson, and she was very sorry to move to Whitehorse. Mm. It took her a long time to accept that that happened. As for many Dawson people, it was a terrible blow.
1951.
53, 54 is when the move took place, but the decision was actually announced in the House of Commons, I think, about 1952 or maybe even 53. It was rumored for a long time.
Right.
And one of the events that hastened the move was the burning of the St. Mary's Hospital. When the hospital burned, there was the whole question of rebuilding, and people in Ottawa said, you know, Whitehorse is the new center for commerce and all other things in the Yukon. We should give up on Dawson. There was very little mining going on.
What they didn't realize is that that was like saying to Ottawa, you should move to Toronto.
Yes. And it was a terrible blow to people who had property in Dawson because property values were declining anyway. And people like Victoria and her father, who was still living, you know, would be left with homes that they had spent money on, paid taxes on, and maintained over the years in a ghost town. And that, in fact, is what happened. They all had to make that move to Whitehorse, reestablish themselves here without the benefit of being able to sell property in Dawson City to reestablish. So it was a terrible blow on so many levels. And Dawson had charm. It had beautiful houses. It had beautiful gardens.
Whitehorse was basically a dust bowl.
We came in 53,
and it was a dirty little, scruffy little dust bowl.
Yeah. And she certainly talks about that, how awful Whitehorse was. And really, I think to the end of her life, although she came to like Whitehorse and came to have lots of friends here, going back to Dawson was a delight to her. Anytime there was an opportunity, if I was traveling there and she, and I would say, well, would you like to come? Immediate.
Tell me about some of your trips to Dawson and what just traveling with her and what she was like.
Well, we had some wonderful,
wonderful
trips because she really, of course, knowing everybody, knowing she was a walking, talking encyclopedia of Yukon people, of Yukon history and events. She had known personally many of the Gold Rush era people.
Oh, sure.
Because she had stayed in Dawson, those who stayed there were personal friends of her family. She'd lived the life on the creeks, so she could talk knowledgeably about that. So our trips to Dawson would be long conversations, mostly her talking and me driving, where she would reminisce. And it wasn't just the people of the Yukon that interested her, but the geology, the landforms, the way that the road had changed through the years. So at different parts of the trip, we would stop and look out at this or that vista, or at this or that spot in the road where the road had diverged in earlier times. So she would reminisce about the early trips on the steamboats before there were real roads in the territory. She would talk about, she had a particular place that she loved, her favorite place, she always used to say, near Carmax. When you climb up the hill going north out of Carmax, and you can stop and look back out over the Yukon Valley.
It's a beautiful spot.
Just above Tantalus. We always stopped there, and she would gaze out at that magnificent landscape. It didn't matter whether it was winter or summer, we stopped there, and she'd look out at it, and just you could just see that she really loved the Yukon. And it was, I don't think she ever painted, I don't think she was an artist in that sense, but she was clearly taking it in a very artistic way. She'd always comment on the colors of the mountains, the changing colors of the river, what a grand sweep of land it was. And that particular spot is, of course, particularly beautiful for that. Then there was another place that she always liked to stop, which was north of Stewart Crossing, when you have the first vista out to the Ogilvie Mountains. And there's that surprising, there's actually a spot now on the highway, a turnout for visitors to take pictures. But before there was that visitor's turnout, that's where she would stop and look out to those mountains. And, you know, there's such a surprising piece of landscape in that little gap there, because it takes you into another region of the Yukon visually. And that was, again, one of the places that seemed to evoke for her all the past times and past people. And she would talk about, you know, how important William Ogilvie had been to Dawson City and what a grand, fine man he was.
She knew him.
Well, I don't think she knew him. I think that she would have been a small child when he left Dawson. But whether he made trips back, or whether just because she had heard him spoken of by the early miners, she talked about how people held him in the highest regard, that he was, you know, a very fine man. So that was another of her favorite places. And then she had places where she liked to fish.
So she liked to fish.
She loved fishing, and she had a little canoe. She had a small cabin at Rock Creek on the Klondike River. And that was her escape on the weekends. So she talked, we'd always stop there, and the cabin's no longer there, but she would show exactly where it was. And then she would say, you know, I would escape from Dawson in my car and drive out, and I would be, you know, a free person for the whole weekend, and I'd be out in my canoe, and I would fish. And it was her solace, I think, in her middle years, because she was, you know, an unmarried woman in a town that consisted mostly of families, and where most of her friends had either left or were married with families. Her own sister, of course, had left and married and had children, where Victoria was in Dawson as a single woman looking after her aging father.
Right. And her mother had died.
Her mother died, I think, probably in the maybe the early 1920s. Mm. So when she was in her early 20s.
Right.
And so thereafter, she was her father's housekeeper. And he was a fairly demanding father. And she needed some place to escape and some time on her own. And this little cabin was that place. And she talked, you know, just with great enthusiasm about being out in her canoe, fishing, or standing on the shore and fishing in the Klondike River at Rock Creek.
Did she ever give any hint as to why she had never married?
She didn't talk about that. She talked quite wistfully about the First World War and all the young men leaving and not coming back. And people who knew her in those years mentioned that there was a young man that she had known, whether they were, you know, just going to box socials and those sorts of things. I never heard her say that she was engaged to someone, or she never mentioned a particular young man. But then I was getting to know her in the 70s, which was a long time after that. But I know that there's often been people who thought that her young man, whoever it was that she was fond of, had gone away to the war and not come back, whether that meant he had been killed or whether, as so many did, they didn't come back to Dawson. There wasn't much for them to come back to by the end of the war. And then there would not have been as many opportunities after that. Because
she would have been a bit fussy by then, too. I mean, you know what I mean.
Well, in the 20s, she would have been
she wasn't 18
moving on
anymore,
in her 20s.
Exactly.
She certainly had a lively interest in social activities. And one of the trips that she took, that she describes on the tapes somewhat, and that is also a tape where I think she talks about it in the Yukon Potpourri series that we sponsored at the archives. I think she talks about this trip too, but certainly she talked to us about it, my husband and I. She went to Hawaii in the late 20s.
But isn't that amazing? I mean, a single woman in the 20s. Even if it was the flapper era, it's still women didn't...
It took a lot of pluck and energy and ambition, really.
Yes, really.
So she went by steamship, landed at Hilo or Hilo on the Big Island, and then she stayed in the Royal Hawaiian Hotel in Honolulu, which is still there.
Yes.
And in her photograph collection here, there are pictures of the hotel and of all the different things that she did in Hawaii. And there's interesting photos of her on board ship with various officers on the ship. And it just makes you wonder, you know, what kind of adventure she was hoping to have in going alone.
Exactly.
And whether she was searching to see if she would meet a young man that that might be a life for her.
Right.
She didn't talk about that, and she certainly didn't talk about regrets in that regard, although she talked very fondly about her her nieces, her sister's children, and she did love children. She would always be watching little kids if we were traveling and there was some playing somewhere. You know, she'd always have a very fond eye for what they were doing. And I think she had a very lovely childhood herself. So that growing up on the creeks was an adventure. Going to school by dog team.
Well, yes.
Going to school at St. Mary's, she seems to have really quite enjoyed the sisters teaching.
The church was important to her throughout her life.
It was. It was very important to her. She wasn't preachy, but it was an abiding part of what gave her strength, I think. One of the last times that I saw her was just after my own first baby was born. And she was so excited that I was going to have this baby. And he was born in January. It was very cold January 1981. And I didn't come to town very much initially because I was living out at Lake LaBarge. And I...
Galen?
Yes, Galen. I came to town this one day and met her in the parking lot at the Bay, the old Bay store, which is now Canadian Tire. And he would have been about 3 months old. And, you know, she was so excited to meet me. And, you know, then, you know, folding back the blanket and looking at him in all his perfection. And then she held him there in the parking lot. And it was, you know, one of those magical moments where you just knew she was feeling this thing of having a baby in her arms. Someone that she knew and that she had, you know, we really had great affection for one another. And, you know, I wished that she died the following summer. She died that summer of 1981, so she never lived to enjoy him as a toddler running around and growing up, but you could tell that that was what was in her mind, was here's a new life, here's someone new to learn to, you know, enjoy and get to know. And it's one of those very special memories I have of her, because I didn't see her much that spring, being a new mom, and the next thing I knew, she was in the hospital and passed away. She had the beginnings of Parkinson's disease, and she opened the SS Klondike. The official opening of the SS Klondike was that June or July, and I forget, I think I had planned to come in, but Galen was teething. Anyway, I missed that event, and the next thing I knew, she had gone to the hospital, and she had died very very quickly after that, and I did not see
heart,
her.
Heart failure?
I don't know. Someone like Flo Wired would probably remember, because I know that, you know, I was very shocked.
They weren't great friends.
Well, they were, I think Flo probably moved on to do some of the things that Victoria could have done in another era. Victoria was a pathfinder for women in responsible positions, women who made a career. Victoria was part of the Business and Professional Women group, as was Flo.
As was Flo.
And Victoria would have been, you know, that much older than those young young people that were founding the group. But I think she was an honored member of the group, and she certainly went to conventions. There are pictures in the collection of her going out to the meetings in Edmonton. Wonderful pictures, where of course they're all in dresses and hats, and very beautifully.
She always wore a hat.
Very beautifully dressed at these conventions, and you could always pick her out because she was very well groomed, very nicely dressed. She prided herself in dressing nicely, and contemporarily as well.
So she followed the fashion.
So I can remember she had some lovely boucle knit suits,
mm-hmm.
and matching hats, mm-hmm. and then she always colored her hair. And that was one of the things that, you know, I always had a great deal of trouble figuring out how old she really was, because she looked and acted
younger.
In a very contemporary way. And even driving her car, of course, was tremendous independence for her. And I think that maybe as the Parkinson's disease came on, that she was not feeling so well that spring and early summer, and perhaps not knowing that she wasn't going to be able to drive, perhaps in the near future, that would not have been a happy thought for her. She never wanted to be old, that's for sure, and never wanted to be anything less than the independent person she had been as a young person. There was never any such thing as, helping her out of the car, or when we would travel, she was, springing out of the car as fast as me, so it wasn't like I could run around and treat her as an elder. She was a strong, vibrant person. You got the sense that she must have been a real dynamo as a young woman, because she was tall. She was,
How tall would she have been about?
I think she must have been 5'8 or 5'9.
Was she really?
Yeah. She was taller than me.
I vaguely remember her. And I do remember her as being tall and slim,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't pay enough attention, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And very erect bearing. Mm. And you certainly, when you see her in the pictures, she is, really very, very beautiful as a young woman, and stylish, and right to her older days. You never saw her that she wasn't well turned out, and carrying herself with that elegance that she had.
There's some story that in the last while she became almost fearful of the world and kind of hibernated in her apartment, and which was supposedly just piled high with everything.
Yeah, I never visited her in her home, interestingly enough. She always met me someplace else. And, she did come out to our cabin at Lake LaBarge,
mm-hmm.
And always when I would pick her up, she'd be downstairs waiting for me.
Right.
So that's a part of her life that I didn't know at all.
The story, Eleanor Millard who was telling me that she once went to her apartment, probably was when Eleanor was in Emily, although I'm not sure, to see her, and she wouldn't allow her in, but Eleanor said the place was just, there was just like a little trail through all the boxes and all of the...
Well, she certainly was always able to produce books or newspaper articles.
She just kept
She must have kept
I guess
her own
kept
files
everything.
Of everything. And some of the other people in town who were older than I was,
mm-hmm.
perhaps would know more about...
Yeah, I know the couple who managed the apartment that she lived in. I thought I'd ask them.
Certainly her collection that came here to the archives.
So it came from her apartment.
Is quite extensive. And she certainly kept photographs. She certainly kept, letters. And it's a very nice collection.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very nice to have it here, because it gives insight into both her and many other of the activities that
exactly.
she was part of.
Yeah.
The photo collections in particular are very interesting,
so
both showing her life.
Data.
I would say so, yeah. So some of the other ways that I knew her, she was a member of the Yukon Historic Sites and Monuments Board.
Yeah, tell me about that. That
was an official appointment. That was our own Yukon Historic Sites and Monuments Board, which
began about when?
Late 60s. And Alan Innes Taylor was on it, and Ken Snyder, and Charlie Taylor, and I was a member of the archivist, and of course that was a who's who of Yukon history.
Yes.
It was a wonderful opportunity to be amongst them, and... Victoria was, of course, an ongoing fountain of information. It didn't matter what site
she was
or
on,
project.
She was on it.
She was a member of the board, and no matter what sites were being considered, that was a time when Yukon government was trying to decide what role to play in historic sites.
It really was, exactly.
And so the board had many, many discussions about the importance of Yukon history and which sites were important, and the meetings were very much taken up with stories of what were the important places, what were the important events, mm-hmm. and why we should be recognizing them. And again, the thing that came across so strongly there was if people, her precision and knowledge and passion for Yukon history, and if people were perhaps mixing up dates or events,
she knew
you could count on Victoria to set them straight. And sometimes that probably was not as welcome by all people, and sometimes there were disputed facts and so forth, but certainly people very often deferred to her knowledge because they knew that she had been so much a part of the ongoing record of Yukon government and of Yukon events. And then as well, Yukon Archives sponsored in the 70s a series called Yukon Potpourri, which we held on Sunday evenings at the Old Y in the big meeting room there. And those were great fun. The intent was to bring together Yukon people that could talk about our history and our cultures. And we had different topics. It was meant to be fun as well as serious historical topics, but one of the ones that I organized was Living with the Yukon Winter. And I think that particular session included Kitty Smith, who's Judy Gingell's grandmother, and Victoria, and Martha and G.I. Cameron.
Oh, right. Okay.
And it was a great fun evening because, of course, they had stories about when the winter was really winter in the Yukon.
Really cold.
And Victoria talked about life on the creeks and then also wintertime activities in Dawson City. She really, she came out to all of our events. Later when a group of us decided to found the Yukon Historical and Museums Association, she was a founding member.
Was she?
And you'll see her in the picture of the founding meeting that's up at the office at YHMA. She was a great supporter of anything to do with preserving Yukon history. So she was very interested in the Dawson City Museum. Kathy Jones, who's now Kathy Gates, was the curator then, and Victoria used to visit the museum and, you know, again, lend her stories or her ideas there, and also was a member of McBride Museum here in Whitehorse. And then with the Yukon Historical and Museums Association, an early activity was to sponsor heritage conferences. And again, she attended all of those and was, you know, just a real enthusiast about promoting Yukon heritage preservation and knowledge of Yukon history. When one of the trips that I took to Dawson with her, I think it was the fall of 1979, we went to Kathy Jones and Mike Gates' wedding. And this particular trip, we went down together, and it might have been that trip or it might have been the previous trip we went down together. Must have been a previous trip because my husband wasn't with us when we made this particular trip. We stopped at the Goulters in Carmack, and they had a beautiful homestead right on the Yukon River. And Ida Mae Goulter, of course, had been born and raised in that area.
I wonder who she was before she was Goulter.
Her parents were, her family name was Back, if I remember rightly.
Back?
B-A-C-K, I think.
Okay. And John Back. Okay.
And then she'd married Frank Goulter, and Frank, of course, had been in the Boer War and then come as an RCM, Northwest Mounted Police.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Officer here. Anyway, they were still living there, the two old people with Frank Jr., their son,
And they would have been, the two older people would have been in their mid-80s then at least, but still living with the help of their son, still growing a beautiful garden,
yes,
lots
right.
of flowers, and it's just the most picturesque place. And when it's situated in such a way that you're able to step back into the days when Yukon River revolved, or Yukon society revolved around the river instead of the highway.
Right.
And Victoria had not seen them, because they didn't come to Whitehorse, I don't think, very often. And she had not seen them, I don't think, since the 50s, maybe. But when we stopped, it was her idea. We were driving, we were getting close to Carmack, and she said, you know, I'd really like to stop and visit with the Goulters. And I thought, oh, well, this must be something she does regularly. Well, no, we went in for tea, and she and Ida May chatted back and forth for at least 20 minutes trying to remember when the last time was. Was it in 1949 or 53, or was it the last time when the boats were running? But, you know, in the course of deciding when they had last seen each other, they covered the grand sweep
sure.
of the 40s and 50s in Yukon and that momentous change from river to highway.
Amazing, yes.
And I didn't have a tape recorder.
I was going to say, wouldn't it have been wonderful to have been able to tape that?
It would have been, because we spent most of the afternoon there having tea and various kinds of goodies and more tea and more tea and more tea. And they covered everybody and everyone that they had mutually known from 1910 on. And so that was some 65 years or so of Yukon history. She really enjoyed that visit. Another visit that we made in Dawson was with the Boutelier sisters. Now that's Art and Margie Fry's, Margie Fry's elderly sisters. And there were two of them, and they lived at that time in a little cabin out at Googieville. And Art and Margie lived in the house right beside them, so they took care of them. But the two Boutelier sisters were of the same age as Victoria, and they'd all gone to school together in Dawson. I think the Boutelier's, well, they might well have gone to St. Mary's, actually, with Boutelier as a name. They may have been Roman Catholic. I don't know that for sure.
I
have to check with some of the Fries. But in any event, they remembered each other as children. And so they had a wonderful time reminiscing about, oh, many things in Dawson. Certainly what it was like to be a child there, all the fun they had sliding and with little dog teams and in the summertime, you know, how wonderful the gardens were and picking flowers. And then in later years, all the wonderful bands and social events that occurred in Dawson. So there was Johnny Dine's orchestra. John Dine Sr. had an orchestra.
Really?
And there were many fine musicians in the community, and of course no television, really not even any radio, and people got together on Saturday nights and had dances, and what wonderful times those were. And they really brought to life that spirited Dawson social life that they all clearly enjoyed each other. It was great fun.
Art Fry, as in
Art Fry the miner,
who
also
was
had
a boxer.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, and he would have been had just moved to Dawson at that time, and he moved there, I think, in the late 20s, and then he and Marjorie were married in the 30s, and they had many social causes. They were also people that very much looked after those who were less fortunate in Dawson, right, all through their lives. But one of the things that they helped organize was called the Dawson Christmas Tree Fund. And they had donations from merchants and people in town to make sure that each and every child in Dawson had some Christmas gift at the party, the community Christmas party that was held. And there's lots of articles in the Dawson newspapers of those parties through the years.
Yeah.
So Victoria remembered that as being a very a very important time in Dawson when people looked after each other and looked out for their neighbors. And she recalled Dawson as being, not always a friendly and Christian community, but that there were highlights like that that spoke well of the community and of the generosity of the people in the community. She also liked to talk about how people looked after their homes. And she could go along the streets in Dawson in the 70s and point out who all had lived in the different houses and remember what kinds of flowers they grew. And she was very cross in the late 70s when, you may remember, they were starting to fix up the roads in Dawson and build the sewage system, and there was mud everywhere. And she talked about how they, you know, people today in government didn't know how to properly maintain the roads. And in her day, the commissioner had always ensured that the white channel gravel had been brought in from the creeks. And he'd send the government trucks and the government graders out to, in the spring, bring in the loads of white channels so that Dawson's streets were properly maintained and you could walk in your good clothes downtown. And now, you know, this would be late 70s, look at these roads, you know, it really was. There were a number of years there where Dawson was a mud bath, and it was awful for people living there. And she was very devastated by the Dawson flood. We went down...
can you remember what year that
was? 79 was the Dawson flood, and that was the year that Mike and Kathy were married. So I think that trip, when we went down when they were married... I remember walking with her around the community, and she was so upset at the devastation. So many of the little houses that we'd gone by in previous years were gone. Her own little cabin had been destroyed by the flood, the house where her father and she had lived. I think it was carried away altogether.
Oh, my.
And just, you know, the community was just really starting to recover that fall. And it was a terrible blow to her, I think. She never really, as she said when she was coming back from that trip, I really don't want to see Dawson again. Because it's so heartbreaking to see so much destruction. And it's not going to look like the town that it was ever again. And, of course, that's when the really big changes started to take
place. That's true.
Because that's when they started to build up the dike in order to protect the town.
And that, of course, is so... I find it still disconcerting when I go to Dawson.
It is. It is. And yet, for the safety's sake, it needs to be there. Now, I think she would have been in her glory to have seen the restored commissioner's residence.
I was thinking about that she would love the way... it has been restored, because she did so much work, didn't she, on researching, as I understand it, after she resigned?
Yeah.
Or after she was finished?
After she retired.
It seems to me I did a fair bit of digging. Did she not do that historic research in the last year or two that she worked for YTG?
She did do some research there, and also then, of course, she went to the Chamber of Commerce.
Yes. Well, did she continue doing research then? What I finally sorted out, I think, is that the research she did, she was retired as the commissioner's secretary, and perhaps it was when Jim
Smith
mm-hmm. became commissioner,
mm-hmm.
And she had an office. Then where she continued to do the work for historic sites, the federal?
She did some research for them, yes. And I
because
think
it appeared that she did, she yeah. researched all of those buildings.
Yeah. And I think that was Jim Smith who really organized that and set that up.
I interviewed Jim, but he didn't claim any credit for organizing it, but he did say she had done.
I think he probably should.
Yeah, I would guess.
I think that it probably wouldn't have happened if he hadn't admired her abilities and her knowledge and felt that it was a resource that it should be utilized. Right. I can't think that it came about in any other way than that he had a hand.
The commissioner would have it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true, isn't it?
But I don't know that for sure. You'd have to look at the records again to see what what the records say. But she certainly was a person who was very concerned that the administrative records of the government be brought together, and she was a big supporter of establishing the archives for the Yukon. And she had been absolutely horrified, as you can imagine, having taken such good care of these records in the central filing system for all those years. It was decided when the capital was moved not to bring all the records with them. And she, amongst others, was given the task of cutting off the files and only bringing certain ones down to Whitehorse. The rest were left in the administration building. And
which wasn't in very good condition.
No, it was basically not maintained for years. And there were many, many records up in the attic.
The administration building and the commissioner, old commissioner's residence, are one and the same, are they not? Or are they?
Well, no, the old administration building is where the Dawson City Museum is now,
yes,
and the law courts.
Right.
And that's where she had worked.
That's where she worked.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And often the commissioner's residence is called the administration building, and I think...
Well, there was another building beside the commissioner's residence that was used for Parks Canada's administration.
Okay.
And that had contained some offices for a time.
Okay.
And you'd have to ask Mike Gates whether they had moved from the old big cabin, as they used to call it,
mm-hmm.
which is where the museum is now, into that other building, which I think was the RCMP office for a time as well, the headquarters. But I believe that Victoria worked in the big administration building.
Okay, but now the museum.
Until the capital was moved to Whitehorse. And the old records going back to the turn of the century had been stored up in the attic of that building.
Mm.
And when they moved in 50... Four.
Not prime record keeping.
Only a few trucks. You know, the road had just opened.
Yes.
And they sent trucks to Dawson to haul the furniture and the records down to, or up to Whitehorse, as
yes.
I would say. And they weren't allowed to bring everything with them. So she always worried about those records. And then later, in the probably mid-60s, early to mid-60s, Allen Innes Taylor was hired by the National Archives to organize those records
mm-hmm.
and get them ready to be shipped to Ottawa. And they were shipped to Ottawa. And then when the Yukon Archives was established, they were shipped back here.
Oh, my goodness.
And
when was Yukon Archives established?
1972.
72.
And those records came back. And that was one of the things that Jim Smith negotiated. And very much Victoria was very happy about that.
Oh,
and
yes.
I'm sure she had been...
Yes.
talking about that for
I'm
some
sure.
time to say you must get those records
yes.
back. And then they were the records that had come down to Whitehorse were stored in various warehouses, some of which burned. So our records are very much not a continuous series. There are major gaps in them.
Yeah.
And that was always a terrible tragedy in her mind that there had been this full body
well,
of
yes.
records.
And now what are we doing here?
And it was lost through lack of
care.
Resources provided by Ottawa, lack of understanding how important that body of records was. And so that's again why when I started working as a government records archivist, it was such a joy to her to know that someone was responsible for looking after them and responsible for finding out how they had come to be. And we spent hours talking about the different series of records and, you know, how she had kept them and so forth. So in our finding aids, there is some discussion about the early records-keeping systems and certainly her role in looking after them was very important for many, many years.
When did you become archivist?
Well, I came as government records archivist
uh-huh.
in 1974, and then Brian Spears was the territorial archivist then.
That's right.
He left in 1976, and I was appointed as territorial archivist in 76. And I left in fall of 1980 when I was expecting Galen,
right.
and came back again in 1990. So I had a decade of being away from the archives, and then I've been back now another decade since 1990.
80 to 90 you left, did you say?
From 1980 to 1990, yeah, exactly 10 years.
Another point of the game. Great.
I know when you listen to her tapes, you'll hear other stories, you know, of the people that she knew, like Joe Boyle.
Yes.
And I think best to hear her tell that in her own
sure.
in her own words. But certainly that was a highlight of her life, to have known him, to have worked out in Bear
Creek. She worked for him.
Yes, she did. That was her first job. And she would only have been maybe 16 or 17.
Mm-hmm.
And again, because it was the First World War, most of the male stenographers had gone off to
That's
war.
That's true,
and
because
so
there were male stenographers.
Here she was, freshly minted from the school in Dawson, taking on a very responsible job in Joe Boyle's company.
Right.
And then moving into the government job when she was probably only about 19.
Yes.
It's really quite amazing. And then, of course, she knew the blacks.
Yes.
I believe that she might have been, her family might have been of a different political persuasion from the blacks. So there were certainly rivalries, politically formed
yes.
rivalries in Dawson.
Oh, yes, very
and,
much.
Those were very strongly felt. So her descriptions of the blacks would always be somewhat reserved. Not that she would say anything bad about them. However, she wasn't, I don't think, she would have been a young girl, too, so
sure.
she would not have been, perhaps, within their social milieu, for other than going to the larger tea parties and so forth.
But, and I suspect, contrary to what seems to be the popular view of Martha Black, she was not, from everything I read and understood about her, she was not particularly proper.
What I know from reading the letters is that she was a very partisan person.
She was.
And
oh, she was.
Of course, the politics were extremely
partisan.
Right.
According to Martha, every liberal was a crook.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some wonderful letters in the National Archives, again, some of which I've copied and are in the research that I did for the council history, and they give a sense for how
it was
really gossipy that part of life was in the
yes.
Yukon, how hard fought the political battles
yes.
were. If we think that we have
nothing now.
politics yeah. now, it was certainly very much more
very
so
personal.
Then, and very personal. So I think Victoria, being a civil servant, had to maintain her distance from that as well, and probably was very concerned about whether her job would continue from one administration
yes,
to the next.
I would think so.
Because there's certainly, in the early years, the civil service was dismissed when political parties changed. But nevertheless, they must have decided that they needed her because she stayed right through. And of course, in those years, she worked for G.A. Jekyll, who from, I think, about 1928 on, was the senior executive officer after
uh-huh.
George Mackenzie left. I think it was 1928.
And she
so really
fond of Jekyll.
Yes, Jekyll and Victoria ran the territory.
Okay.
And as Jim Smith very often will say, Victoria actually ran the
yes.
territory for large periods of time because
he went.
He would go to Ottawa for the budget preparations.
Yeah.
He'd be gone a good part of the winter.
Sure, he'd stay for the winter.
And she did everything, yeah. She also knew the Burtons, and she talks about them a little bit on her tape. I think she found them a bit odd, and they probably were very different in their interests. When you read I Married the Klondike,
yes,
the two of them as a couple had
yeah.
very eclectic interests,
didn't they?
And
true. I should
they would have
that.
Been quite different from the civil service kind of lifestyle that Victoria was living. And so I find it very fascinating, the different flavors of Yukon life that you find coming out of the different memoirs that people have left, including Victoria's tapes. It's a shame she didn't write
It is, isn't
more.
It? Because she could have.
She could have, and I wonder. Maybe she just never got around to it. Because she was very busy with
the other activities.
It's a lot of work, right?
It is a lot of work,
as you know.
Also on that tape is her story of the first airplane ride in the UK.
Oh,
isn't that a fabulous
story?
Yes,
back on the way
back from Hawaii.
Hawaii. Can you imagine going into goodness knows how cold in Mayo? You know, because it goes down.
Well, she said it was. She said it was. You know, I think minus 50 or something, and
50 below.
This 50 below Fahrenheit, yes. And how cold it was
in an open cockpit. I mean.
Well, I suppose it wouldn't have been going very fast in those little planes, but maybe it was warmer up above. You know, the air might have been warmer up above. I don't know. It certainly sounds like an adventure.
My.
And that tape is well worth listening to for the detail that she provides on that. And then I guess maybe a final story just about her and my own family. She came for Christmas at Lake LaBarge, and that would have been Christmas of 1979. My father had passed away in June, and my mother came for her first Christmas in the Yukon at our cabin at Lake LaBarge, and of course we had no electricity, so we had our beautiful large tree, because it's a cabin with a high roof, we always have a nice big tree, and we have candles on the tree. And so she came mid-afternoon, and we all had dinner together, and some friends of ours were living on the far side of Lake LaBarge at Laurier Creek, and the lake had just frozen over, but we hadn't heard from them, and we were hoping they were going to come for Christmas dinner. So mid-afternoon, when we hadn't seen them, my husband David got on the snowmobile and went across the lake. First he went to town and got Victoria, and so then she was out, and my mother and she and I were visiting, having tea and admiring the tree. And then my husband went across and got Mike and Marlene from Laurier Creek. And that, to her, just seemed like an old-time Yukon Christmas.
Oh, it would, wouldn't it?
Where people came from distances not by road, but it would have been dog team if she could have had it that way, but it was a snowmobile. And we had our dinner, and then we lit the candles on the Christmas tree. And I have this wonderful picture of the lit tree and her gazing at it. And it really was an incredible moment, because it took her back to, I think she said 1903 was their last Christmas on the creeks. And, of course, after that they'd moved to town.
Of course, and so they had
electricity. And I suppose even electric lights for trees. I don't know at that point. But in any event, that tree in the cabin took her back to the creeks, to her mom and her dad and her sister and her Christmas with the lit tree, and how magical that was. And she just couldn't stop exclaiming over how beautiful it was. And that's, I guess, probably my favorite memory of her.
Yeah.
She was like a little girl again.
That was what year?
1979. Yeah, Christmas 79 at Lake LaBarge.
Nice.
And magical moment. And that, certainly whenever we would get together, she'd always remember that.
Yeah.
And she died 2 years later. So really,
that,
that next Christmas I was supposed to be having Galen, actually.
Right.
He was due the 28th of December. So we talked about having her out for Christmas, but it was a very cold Christmas. And we ended up not doing Christmas together. And as it turned out, she died in the springtime then.
Hmm.
So our Christmas at Lake LaBarge was probably the last and very, very special Christmas for her, and certainly for us too.
Oh, yes. She died here, of course.
She died in Whitehorse. And it probably was August of 1981. Yes, Gray Mountain?
Yes, of course, because I went up. I actually have a photograph of her grave.
And her funeral at was at Sacred Heart, and of course very well attended.
Right.
And it was, I found very interesting the number of people through the years who had come to know her. And I guess one of the people I sat with was Jan Horton. And Jan had gotten to know her because Victoria had been very active in the Golden Age Society, and was working with Jan to establish new services for seniors. And So Dan's another person who would have memories of her from those years.
And she was, I believe, part of the group that started the Golden Age Society.
Yes, she was. Yeah.
There are so many stories about how it started. I would love.
That would be a history of itself, wouldn't it?
No, I don't think you could ever get the right story here.
Well, you get many stories.
You get many stories.
Yeah, and it was certainly a very lively group because the reception after Victoria's funeral was held at the Golden Age Society. That little gray building right beside the theater, that was the old
clubhouse. So that was the old
clubhouse.
Black reading room or library. That was the IODE library one time.
And then the Golden Age Society.
And then the Golden Age Society.
Yeah. And
that's where the reception was.
It was. And, of course, it was a very lively gathering of mostly senior citizens by that point. But very clear that she had been an active member of that group and continued to put her organizing skills and her lobbying skills to work right up to the end. She never quit.
She didn't speak badly about First Nation people at all.
No, she is very respectful of First Nations people, and that, again, I often remember things from our travels, but...
You spoke about her going to Pali.
Yes. The one trip that we made, there was an older man, very old Indian man, standing by the road hitchhiking between Stewart and Pali. And I was driving a government car, and I'm not supposed to pick people up, of course, but he was standing there on the road, and it was probably, might have been October. It wasn't really cold, but it was, it was brisk. And I said to her, you know, I'm not supposed to pick anybody up. And she said, oh, it's only a government car. You should stop and get him. He might need something. In the old days, no one ever,
I know, and that's true,
went by somebody on the road. And so I stopped, and we picked him up, and of course it was someone she knew. And to have had a tape recorder all the time that I was with her, I'd just die now. But she spoke to him right away, told him who she was, and knew who he was.
So she was respectful in that.
Very respectful. And then they had a great chat about...
a little bit there.
About other people that she knew from Fort Selkirk days. And, of course...
He would have been from Fort Selkirk.
Yeah, and he didn't speak a lot of English, but they had a grand conversation together. And we got to Pali Crossing, and he said, this is where I get out. And so we stopped, and as he got out, he shook her hand, and she was, just so delighted to have seen him. And... away we went again, and she said, you must remember that you never pass anyone on the road. It doesn't matter who they are. And I could just tell that for her, didn't matter that he was a little bit ragged looking. He'd obviously just walked out of the bush from somewhere, and there he was standing by the road. So it didn't matter that he was a First Nations person. It didn't matter that he, we were two women traveling alone. What was he going to do anyway? But that he was a person standing by the road, and I was not to drive by him. And, these days I do often drive by people, particularly in government cars. I don't pick people up. But
it always upsets me when I do.
I don't like to do it. And I can hear her voice in the background saying, you never pass someone. And if it's wintertime, I don't pass someone on the road. And I felt like I was, again, going back in time where that was a very, very firm code in the UK.
And it was, in the 50s when we came up here. Absolutely. You're out on the highway. You never went by anyone. And it's true. We didn't, ever. And, of course, Earl drove for United Kingdom Hill Mines, who had a very firm policy that you didn't pick up people. But he picked the people up. We still meet people downtown that he knows. I say, who are they? He said, I don't know. I used to give him a ride from Carmex to Kelly or back and forth.
Wherever.
Or whatever.
They're standing out on the road, and very few people had cars in the community in those days. People were often hitchhiking. They were community people hitchhiking. So you knew you were picking up someone that
picking up a neighbor.
With a neighbor, yes. Yeah, one way or another. And in her case, she knew exactly who it was, too.
Yes.
And I always remember, sometimes we always stop for tea in Carmanax. And she also knew, and I think this is probably sometimes disturbed people that she knew so much about everyone. And she would say, well, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so, they always lived together as man and wife.
Yes,
but they never were married.
Well, I know. And there was lots of that in the days that it wasn't acceptable.
And she would remember different people that, and then she'd say, but then I remember so-and-so, and they came in and got their marriage license, and, you know, so they were properly married.
Yes.
And she was also the vital statistics registrar. So she had registered every marriage, every death, and every birth.
It's mind-boggling to think of what she did.
Yes.
See, she not only was very, obviously very smart, very bright, well-educated, but and efficient, but put through an incredible amount of work.
Yes, I think your statement, a one man or one woman show, is very near to the truth for those intervening years, certainly from the late 20s through to the 50s.
Not only did she do all that, she did the filing, which is a one person job, is it now?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think she has no one
she's
like
an
her.
Astonishing person,
really.
I think so. I wonder if she was extremely bright. Would that have been your.
Oh, I think so, yes. Yeah, I think today. With all the opportunities that many women have today, that the she would have gone to university. I think of her as, you know, being a PhD in economics or a lawyer. She would have made such a fine lawyer because she had a mind that did not forget detail ever. And she was interested in detail.
She must have almost had a photographic memory to remember everything that.
I think so, but then also, you know, she would have been typing everything.
That's true. So, you experience it,
yeah,
and then you type it, and then you file it. So
yeah.
You have three.
And she had the perfect contextual background for everything because she had grown up here.
Yes.
She'd seen the Yukon through so many changes. And so she lived it, she saw it, she wrote it, and she remembered it.
So in the greater scheme of things, it was very appropriate that the Victoria Faulkner Women's Center was named after her.
Yes, I think
and
she was delighted
was she,
by that
was
idea.
She?
Yes, she
I,
was.
I, for me, because I've always felt a bit guilty about it, I guess it doesn't matter if it's on this, because this tape is on half speed and it's no good to anybody else and it'll eventually get erased anyway. But, she epitomizes for me what strong, caring women can be.
Yeah, she's very multidimensional.
Yes.
And what I liked about it.
And I'm so glad that she was delighted.
Yes, yeah. And what I liked about it was that it did connect the pioneering spirit of the Women's Minibus Society and
mm-hmm.
the era of those of us who were young activist women
yes.
then.
Yes.
It connected us and it connected the center to the people who had gone earlier
yes.
who, like her, really had to. Buck the system in order to do the things that she did.
And when you think, and I know it's true, that secretaries were male
mm-hmm.
in the era that she became one.
She was one of the very earliest women, and she very much thought of herself as a pioneer, and she had the heartbreaks of pioneering.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that it must have been fun for her to have listened to some of the more colorful descriptions of the radical women of
yes,
the 70s,
I'm sure.
And some of the scuttlebutt that was going around White Horse about what would be done in this women's center.
Oh, yes, exactly.
You know, it was going to, foster divorce and women leaving their husbands and abandoning their
families.
Yes. And, and in part that was a problem with the bus, too, was
women
could get out from their house.
Goodness sake. I know.
And I think Victoria actually reveled in that part of
good.
It. I can't remember actually talking to her about it other than that she was very honored by the name being selected. And
I'm so pleased. Because
and she saw it as, a natural continuum from the Women's Business and Professional Club.
It was.
And so she was, I think she just was totally delighted by it. And there might have been even a little degree of her catching the humor of it, too. You know, because she was a person...
Well, she was obviously bright enough, so she would have picked
up. She appreciated irony tremendously.
Okay.
So I expect that
she knew.
She had her secret laugh over that on many fronts.
Okay. In many ways. More than once.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I have a feeling that she was probably glad it was her and not some of the others.
Well, sure.
Because she was the senior
woman
in so many ways.
And at that time, she had just, not long before, retired officially, I guess, from the Chamber of Commerce, because I remember there was a bit of a fuss in the paper.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that she felt very much that her single status was held against her.
Oh, it would have been.
And,
absolutely.
What could she do about it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you were persona non grata if you were you were a spinster.
You know what she identified with was which I grew up with, Charlotte Whitten in Ottawa.
Oh yeah,
Mayor Charlotte Whitten, and there was.
I bet she would have identified.
Yes,
her.
And you can think back to how strong you would have had to have been to be the only woman
Whitten
doing that stuff.
No kidding.
Yeah, and all of the. Terrible things people said about
her. Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Now, I'm sure I'll have a zillion
more questions. Yeah, well, it'll be fun